Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Over the past few months, people and cities and towns all across the country have turned public spaces into platforms for organized protests over economic inequality. And they have argued that their right to assemble and speak is guaranteed by the Constitution, and certainly it is. However, others have countered, particularly people in government, have countered that this is a right that is not without limits. So the question is, what rules apply to public demonstrations, and what happens when demonstrators find themselves facing the police? This morning in this hour of Focus, we have as our guest Ed Yanka. He's Director of Communications and Public Policy with the American Civil Liberties Union of Illinois. Spend a lot of his time talking about issues just like this one on television, on radio, in this state and throughout the nation. And he's here visiting in Champaign-Urbana. We're happy to have him here in the studio with us. And we'll talk in this hour about the First Amendment, freedom of expression, the right to protest, and questions and comments from people who are listening are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, if you would like to join us, is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email. It's will-talk@illinois.edu. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to be with you.
For people like you and your organization, I'm sure you're thinking about the First Amendment all the time. For most people, it seems like the interest in it rises and falls, and because of where we are now, particularly with the Occupy protests that we've seen going back to last year, I think now people are thinking about it and are wondering, well, you know, they have this sense that there is this right to assemble, to speak. And also, though, I'm sure that there are questions about, well, what ways can that right be regulated? Because clearly it can be. Do you see this as now being a time when lots of folks that ordinarily wouldn't be thinking about this are?
I hesitate a little because you're right. We think about this right all the time. And we think about how important it is for people to be able to speak to government and to speak to their leaders and the people who guide our policymaking and make clear that, you know, it is important and critical that we you know, be able to do that in a way in which our message reaches those very leaders that we intend. And yet, I think you're right. At the same time, it is not something I think we often that many of us often think about on a day-to-day basis. There is a sense that, oh, I have this right. Oh, I can write a blog. I can publish something, you know, on my own website. I can post to Facebook. You know, I can do all of them. I could post to Twitter. There's a, you know, a myriad of things we do to express ourselves. But I think one of the things that's happened, and I will say, I think over the last couple of years, with regards to it, going back even longer than that, with regards to the protests against the Iraq War, the Tea Party movement, and then the Occupy movement, is I think that people are beginning to understand that there really has been what I would call a sophisticated effort to move protests out of the public square and to limit the ability of large groups of people to gather in a way that allows them to address concerns they have with the government, no matter which ideological perspective they have. And that these have been, you know, sort of a series of steps which courts have approved and governments have taken over the last, 20 plus years, that I think at the end of the day really leave us oftentimes with a limited ability to exercise that First Amendment right in the way that we think as an organization, but I think many of us think as Americans is really endemic and instinctual for the way we live. You know, I think it's important to remember that when we talk about the First Amendment, that most of us think immediately of the notion of freedom of speech.
Yeah.
That's the, you know, it's the rock solid, the most important thing. But also embedded in there is the right to petition our government. And oftentimes the way in which people choose to petition the government, the way in which people choose to express themselves is through a collective organization of individuals who gather together with a central message. That right is, it seems to me that when you link those together, it is really critical that we protect and frankly that we, you know, preserve, I fear, as much of this ability of people to gather in these ways as we can. Because unfortunately, again, in the name of security and for a host of reasons I think we'll talk about, you know, courts have increasingly allowed and permitted government to roll back those opportunities.
Yeah. Well, I think that, as you say, that people who are people who have something to say and want to be heard by their fellow citizens and by government, they're going to want to do that in a way that will they would hope guarantee that they are heard. But then there are questions for, as you say, for reasons of security, for public safety, for the right of one set of individuals to go about living their lives, that you might say, OK, you want to have a demonstration, that's fine, but you can't stand out in the middle of the street and stop traffic.
Correct.
You know, so the question is, how much power does government have, and who decides where you draw the lines when it comes to placing limits on what people can do?
Yeah, I think the point that you've raised is an appropriate one, and we're always, you know, I think that we do all recognize that there's a balance. For example, we have the right to gather together to protest, as you say, or as I think. We don't have the right to come out here in the middle of Springfield Avenue and shut down traffic coming both ways because we're not happy over the available parking or, you know, pick an issue, whatever issue, you know, moves one or motivates one at a particular moment. There are, and so those requirements, for example, that a group get a parade permit if they're going to march on a public thoroughfare are perfectly appropriate. That's something that I think we recognize that, you know, often is appropriate and important to be done. The notion that you have to get a permit in order to have time or access to one of the central plazas that one has, in a particular area. Again, I think you can, you know, you can't have five different groups show up at Federal Plaza on a particular day to have this, you know, to have competing protests. And so scheduling time and requiring people to have, some sort of permit in order to do that is permissible. And something that's allowable, you know, on that score, one of the things that we've seen that crosses the line is in the central kind of plaza areas. Oftentimes government will permit, you know, will grant a permit to a group to have a demonstration and then suggest that no one else can show up there on that day with any other message. So in other words, even if someone were having a demonstration on a plaza to celebrate the anniversary of Roe v. Wade on the pro-choice side, the notion that anti-abortion activists couldn't show up and pass pamphlets or, you know, hold signs is absurd. It's a neutral governmental site. It is certainly allowable, and I think that you schedule an event for there, but you can't close people off from being part of that. You see other things which courts have now allowed, for example, that when you can certainly picket and protest on a public street, on a public sidewalk, for example, without going into the street, and you are permitted to do that. But one of the requirements that courts have upheld is that the people who are engaged in that protest must continually move. They must be active the entire time that they're there. And I have to say that actually in the Occupy movement in Chicago, we've seen the city actually gave a little latitude with that in the financial district. The city actually, I will just say from my own observation, didn't always require people to be moving. In fact, I would say early in the morning, there was more of a camaraderie between the police officers and the protesters than there really was a sense of keeping them moving. And they actually, in front of the Federal Reserve Building, because the sidewalk are so narrow, they actually carved out a little more space for them on the street in one lane of LaSalle Street to be able to go out into that. But suggesting that you can't close that off, or suggesting that you can't block a street or block a sidewalk by simply standing is something that, you know, courts have allowed. And then, not permitting people to use amplification systems in particular areas where there's commerce or a residential area, during particular times of the day. You couldn't, you couldn't sit outside a governor's house who you disagreed with and simply blast some music that the governor might not like at all hours of the night or day as a form of protest against a particular governmental action. All of those things, I think, are things that are widely accepted. And I think in some ways, people have come to accept that is a matter of assuring that not only do the protesters get a chance to articulate and convey their message, but that protest does not, in the end, disrupt commercial or residential activity in a particular area.
Yeah. I have a caller here, and I will not make them wait any longer. Other people who are listening certainly are invited into the conversation with your questions, comments. The guest in this part of Focus is Ed Yonka. He is Director of Communications and Public Policy with the American Civil Liberties Union of Illinois. And we're talking about the First Amendment, the right to speak and protest, and questions are certainly welcome. And we have one here who has been waiting in Urbana, so we'll get right to them on our line one.
Yes, thank you, David. Mm-hmm. I'm glad that Mr. Yonka is talking about what he is. He might expand this into talking about how that right has been violated, for example, during the Free Trade of the Americas meetings in Florida and at the Republican National Convention in Minneapolis, with the intrusion of the federal government cooperating through fusion centers with the local police. But I want to ask about another issue which we are facing locally in regard to the Champaign Police Department. And that is, we have had a couple of cases of black young men who have been stopped and felt that they were stopped for no other reason than being profiled because they weren't committing an arrestable act. And when they verbally protested, in one case, 2 years ago, he was smashed to the ground and his face was messed up, and he was charged with resisting arrest. And in a more recent case that happened last June, a young man was stopped by an officer because he had jaywalked at 2 in the morning. There were lots of other young people, most of them white, walking around. He turned around and said, "Well, I didn't do anything." The officer would have grabbed him by the arm, threw him on the hood of the car, and when he was already on the hood of the car and they were handcuffing, the officer pepper sprayed him and later choked him inside the squad car, and the camera caught this. In the first case, the young man was prosecuted for resisting and convicted. In the second case, the state's attorney refused to issue the charge, press the charge of resisting arrest. But the problem is that it seems that police officers are abusing people who object to their arrest, saying there was not sufficient ground for it, or you're racially profiling me. And on the basis of that speech, then they are harmed either by being smashed on the sidewalk or by having the pepper spray sprayed on them. And in this other case, the individual was choked as he continued to say, "Why are you doing this? Why are you arresting me?" Has the ACLU been attentive to this distinction between, on the one hand, actually resisting arrest or indicating verbally that you are not going to cuff me, I am not going to permit you to arrest me, as opposed to, you have no grounds for this, you're violating my rights?
Yeah, the short answer is we have been attentive to that. And in fact, we've actually been attentive to this issue going back one step further, which is continuing to raise concerns over the disparate number of stops and searches of people of color. And particularly, I would say, as the caller describes, young men of color as the result of, you know, I think some bad profiling work on the part of some police officers. I think this is an issue. I would just say, just briefly, I don't think this is really an issue which is about the speech. Because quite frankly, we hear lots of instances of this where it's not because someone articulates a particular protest, but simply because they even might stay silent and it therefore creates a reaction on the part of a police officer that is far in excess of what the situation warrants. And so I think those are issues that one, you know, we've been attentive to, and two, I think we all have to continue to be cognizant of and work on. Let me also say about the first issue that the caller raised with regards to abuses or limitations on free speech at these major national events. What these are actually termed security events, national security events, things like the conventions, the upcoming G8 and NATO summits in Chicago. And what we see in those instances, in the cases of the federal government and the local government interacting, is that there's always a push to the rules to limit where people can speak and how they can speak. In Chicago, you know, for example, the summit is upcoming in May, and the city thus far refuses to even issue a schedule for what's going to happen and where it's going to happen and what their guidelines are going to be in terms of people protesting. At one point in time, they suggested to a local group that Daley Plaza, the central area with the Picasso sculpture that I think everybody's aware of, would be closed for the duration of the event, even though it is a highly iconic and recognizable place for people to gather and protest and have for years and years and years. And, you know, they finally relented and said that that would be open. But one of the things that we've seen in all of these events across the country in terms of conventions is that cities wait until the 11th hour. They issue plans. Those plans also are almost always include these quote unquote free speech zones that are located afar from any of the central activity and where any of this activity would receive any really favorable media coverage. Protesting groups sue. The courts almost always reverse these. And one of the things they always criticize the government for is waiting so long to announce a plan, because that plan could well be negotiated over if it was released earlier, you know, without having to resort to litigation. And so, you know, any time that I think we get this federal local intersection, we have seen this as a matter of great concern.
Can I raise just one additional issue, and that is freedom of the press? In regard to this, where in the case of the Minneapolis thing, they went into places where the press was preparing to cover it and took equipment, cameras, and so on before even the demonstrations had started. And then secondly, in New York, there was an article in the New York Times the day before yesterday, I think, of where they simply arrested people from the press who were covering this and prevented other press people from access to the event, and Mayor Bloomberg defended that.
Yeah, that was an element of that we saw in much of the Occupy movement. When there would be these sweeps, they would sweep up journalists who were there to cover it, which I think, again, you know, really denigrates the ability for people to, you know, understand what's going on. I think it's been a troubling development across the country. And David, as we were talking about before the show, I think one of the things about all of these issues is that, you know, courts have issued have sort of walked the line back in terms of what's permissible in favor of government. And I think rather than take that as a win or a victory, if you will, on the part of government and their ability to control situations or to keep security, you know, I think government has taken that off too often as an invitation to seek further limitations. You know, one of the things that we've been very concerned about in the situation with the upcoming summits in Chicago is that the mayor and the city council are about to pass ordinances that hike the fines for people who are violating protest rules. that change the protest rules significantly, that create some burdens on people who want to put together large groups and large protest groups. And there's this sense of acting tough, you know, putting on the muscle right away. And no one ever saying, why don't we all sit down in a room and figure out where you want to protest, what you want to achieve, and how we can accomplish that, understanding that the feds are going to come in here and want to really lock down security with all these heads of state. I think it's just a missed opportunity on the part of government to say that, you know, we can have security and yet at the same time be open to people who have opposing views.
We have some other callers here. I want to thank the last and continue and to go next talk with someone in Atlanta, Illinois, on our toll-free line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I've got a question for you. In what regard do you think the Arab Spring has contributed to possible liberalization of our own demonstrations? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay.
I wish that I could say that the Arab Spring, you know, has added to the liberalization of our demonstrations. I will say that I think that the Arab Spring has encouraged many people to go out in the streets. I think that certainly it is very difficult to watch many of these scenes from, you know, Tahrir Square or from Syria and not feel a sense of, or a desire to want to go out and be part of a group and speak your mind, you know, when you see issues that are confronting this country like those. But I think at the same time, you know, what's troubling is that we often hear political leaders who on the one and governmental leaders who on the one hand applaud those gatherings and those mass gatherings and at the same time then want to limit the ability of people right here in the United States to exercise their First Amendment rights. I think it's been very troubling. And I will just say to raise one other issue because it's a favorite hobby horse of mine and an issue that we're involved in. The reason that we've seen so much coverage, and particularly if you think about inside Syria, is because people have been able to use handheld cameras and recording devices and then send that data out of Syria to other countries where it's been rebroadcast. In Illinois, unfortunately, if you were to videotape and audiotape a police officer engaged in his or her duties on the streets, you could be subjected to a penalty for eavesdropping and subjected to criminal punishment, a felony. And so, you know, I think that, you know, in some ways we're seeing this great movement across the world, and I'm not sure that we're always keeping up in terms of the promises of our Constitution.
Yeah. Another caller here, someone who clearly is listening online there in Seattle, Washington, line number 2. Hello.
Hi. I was interested in whether or not the guests could talk about differences between perhaps the way the Tea Party protesters have been dealt with by police and the 99% protesters. I can't recall seeing any videos of the Tea Party getting, you know, pepper sprayed, anything like that. Maybe it happens, but I don't recall seeing it, and perhaps speculation or legal basis on if there is a difference that he perceives, you know, what might be the cause of that. That's all.
All right. Well, what do you think?
I don't recall, I would agree with the caller, I don't recall seeing any instances in which Tea Party participants or protesters were pepper sprayed. I will say that there were some instances where Tea Party groups were protesting, particularly in Washington, D.C., and were often moved to a location where they were distant or at some distance from the ability of them to really reach the members of Congress who they wanted to hear their message. In that way, I think some of the treatment has been the same. Although I think it is, to be sure, there has not been the element of Tea Party protesters occupying particular areas and then police coming through to clear those areas off and often using measures that none of us thought and none of us would reasonably think were really necessary or appropriate in order to disrupt or to move those protests along.
Mm. And some of the things that you've said in reaction and in response to the callers raise a number of different areas we might go into. But there's one here I did want to have you talk about, and it applies to the demonstration issue. It applies to the comments of the caller about, you know, what happens when you come in contact with the police. And essentially that is, what sort of advice do you give to people about how, if they're interacting with a police officer, how they should conduct themselves?
Yeah, it's a great question, David. And you know, I know that the advice I'm about to give people is often difficult to hear, or I should rather say it's easy to hear in this moment. It's often difficult to hear in the emotional moment when you're having the interaction with a police officer. But what we've always advised people is really, I think, a threefold strategy for those moments. First is to remain calm and not to engage in any sort of emotional reaction which accelerates or accentuates the interaction with the police in a way that could work against, you know, your best interest. So that's first of all. The second thing that we have always said to people is that it is perfectly appropriate to question an officer about why it is that you are being stopped or detained in some way, and to ask whether or not you're being detained, and even to invoke your rights in terms of not having your car searched and things of that nature. But again, you know, the I don't want to say the trick, the important element here is to do that in a respectful and a mindful way that allows you to actually engage the officer in a conversation, as opposed to creating again more tension. In that regard, though. If you're in a situation where an officer tells you to disperse, is giving you a lawful order, as they describe it, to disperse or to move along, we've always advised people to follow those lawful orders. You know, you can, if you think that something was really wildly inappropriate, you can come back and challenge that later. And I'll get to that in just a second. But I think it's important at that moment, both to ensure the safety of yourself and others around you, to follow that lawful order and not try to resist in any way. I know that people believe in civil disobedience. It is a tool that people have used as part of protest for as long as there's been protest. And there are people who think, you know, lying down and blocking access and doing those things are important. That's not something that we would recommend to people, because it just creates a more physical and personal interaction between the citizenry and the police in those cases. The third thing is that when one finds oneself in those situations too, is simply, and this is the part about remaining calm, is to take in as much information as, you know, one can. If you're being stopped by the police, to just say to them, "May I have your name and your badge number?" To look at your watch and or your phone and figure out precisely what time it is. Where are you exactly? You know, what cross street are you at, on which street? Where is this happening? If you have friends with you, to be able to say, you know, are you guys taking this all in? Let's make sure we remember all of this as it's going along. And I think that ability, you know, I think many of us are often disappointed and disheartened at how difficult it is to challenge police activity, to register a complaint and to, you know, facilitate, you know, carrying out a complaint against police officers. But one of the things that we've seen is across the country and across Illinois is that process works best when the individual involved has as much information as possible. And so anything that you can gather up at that moment is really, really important to do. And I think that's the other thing that we always encourage folks to try to do if they ever find themselves in that kind of circumstance.
Mm. Something else, and this is has been an issue here in this community. I'm sure there have been an issue other places, and it's another thing we touched on, and that is this prohibition against filming a police officer when he or she is in the course of doing
not filming, audio taping. The filming is permissible. It's when you turn on the audio tape that it's not permissible.
Oh, okay. So, well, I guess here I'm a little bit confused because I thought that there was sort of a blanket ban. And I think the question that the people would ask was, well, here, this is a public official in public doing their public duty. And do I, is there not some right of people to monitor what it is that I mean, what is the justification against, and particularly why is it okay if you say, okay, I'm going to I will silently videotape what the person is doing, but I can't have any sound?
I wish I had a good answer to your question. I don't. And let me tell you, we have, as you know, this has become an issue across the state of Illinois. Mm-hmm. There was a judge from just south of here, a district court judge, our circuit court judge, who actually declared the Illinois eavesdropping statute as applied in these kinds of cases to be unconstitutional. That case is going up on appeal. There was a young woman in Chicago who had been charged with a felony for eavesdropping in this case. The jury in that case rejected the government's arguments and acquitted her in what I think was a clear sense that the jury just couldn't believe that it could be against the law to engage in this activity. We've challenged this law in federal court on behalf of the ACLU because we've done police monitoring, you know, since the 1968 demonstrations in Chicago and before. And one of the things that we often, you know, one of the things that was remarkable to us was with this changing technology, we couldn't go to a protest and we could go to the protest and film it. We could take notes. We could come home and come back to the office and post those notes and the film on our website, but we couldn't turn on the audio of a video camera in order to capture the interaction between a police officer and a citizen or a civilian. You know, it is something that we, as I say, we're challenging. We're now up in the Seventh Circuit on that case and awaiting a decision. You know, I think these cases as they play out in the state court are going to make a difference. There's going to be a legislative effort this spring to try to change this law so that you can record a public officer conducting his or her public duty in the public way and do that without fear of being prosecuted. What is ironic, if not downright frustrating about this is that, of course, over the last several years, we have seen an explosion in the amount of public surveillance that is conducted by government. Mm-hmm. And you know, look, some of this surveillance, I'll say, is good and has been helpful. The caller earlier made reference to, you know, the camera in the squad car. You've had the cameras mounted on the front of the squad cars that you know, record the interaction between police and people they've stopped. You have the cameras that are often used in order to record interrogations of individuals so that it's clear that there's no coercion of someone in obtaining a confession, which was something that we saw in stark horror here in Illinois around the death penalty issue. And then, of course, there's the whole issue of surveillance cameras and the way that they're used in the public way. In every one of those instances, the public officials and governmental officials who defend those things always say that you don't have a right to privacy when you're in the public way. Okay, fair enough. But if I'm wearing a uniform, suddenly I get that cloak. It doesn't make any sense. It defies all logic to think that an individual who's a public official, paid for with your and my tax dollars, engaged in his or her public duties in the public where I can see them, where I can hear them, where I could write down verbatim what they say and report that, I simply can't record. It just defies all logic and all sense. And I think and it doesn't for most people in large measure, I think, because most of us carry smartphones and think of them now as being an appendage to our body, and we can't imagine someone telling us how we can and can't use them from government. And I think this will be something that'll be reversed. But it's an amazing contradiction here that on the one hand, there's this claim that we have no privacy, but that somehow a public official ought to have a heightened sense of privacy in that instance.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Ed Yonka. He's Director of Communications and Public Policy for the American Civil Liberties Union of Illinois. We're talking about the First Amendment, the right to free speech, and the right of protest. We'll talk some more after a very short break. This is Focus.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, preserving our nation's music heritage at the University of Illinois. Now featuring new exhibits entitled A Century of Stories and Sounds from the Stage, Music, Dance, and Theater in America. More information is at sousaarchives.org.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, 10 different topics every week. Hour two today, your opportunity to ask computer questions. We do this every month on the show. So if you have a problem wanting to buy a new computer, the one you got isn't working, we have two guests there, both with Campus Information Technologies and Educational Services here on the campus of the U of I, Jim Eirich and Deborah Flieger. So that's hour two. Celeste Quinn is the host. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll talk about the long battle over the Second Amendment. Our guest there will be Adam Winkler. He's professor of constitutional law at the University of California, Los Angeles, and we will talk about his recent book, Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. You can check the schedule, see what we'll do in the days ahead by going to the website. That's WILL.illinois.edu, and that way you can also listen to past programs. The guest in this hour of Focus is Ed Yonka. He's Director of Communications and Public Policy with the American Civil Liberties Union of Illinois. And questions are welcome as we continue to talk about the right to speak and protest and assemble. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have another caller here. And again, this is someone in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Yes, I wonder if you could tell the ACLU's position on Citizens United and corporate personhood, and I'll listen off the air. Thanks.
All right. Does the ACLU take a position on that?
We did not take a position with regards to particularly corporate personhood or with regards to what finally became the Citizens United decision. Let me back up a step and just remind everybody that The Citizens United case, when it first went to the Supreme Court of the United States, was really focused on a very narrow question. And the question was whether or not Citizens United as a group could place on the Comcast or other cable systems on demand a documentary that they had put together an argument against Hillary Clinton being elected as president of the United States. So they put this documentary together and they wanted to broadcast it using the on-demand feature. And according to a stipulation in the McCain-Feingold Campaign Reform Act, they were not able to do it because it was perceived to be an ad directed at a particular candidate for an office that occurred within a certain part of or a certain number of days before an election. They challenged that. That went up. At that point, the Supreme Court heard arguments on that narrow piece. And I will say that the ACLU actually was on the side of Citizens United about these time restrictions because we think that groups ought to be able to have issue ads that are about particular issues and mention a candidate even in the midst of an election campaign. In fact, we had tried for years to run ads during the election cycle that were aimed at then House Speaker Dennis Hastert about the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, but were not permitted to do so because of the restrictions of McCain-Feingold in the sense that that was then engaging in a political act. We continue to argue about that issue. Unfortunately, I would say, I think in terms of the outcome, the Supreme Court asked for a rehearing on the issue, raised these larger issues about corporate donations, and ultimately came up with this definition about corporate personhood, which is not an issue on which, you know, we had ever taken a position before.
Okay. I didn't want to ask you about another case. I don't know if this is something that you've been following. It is a case. I think the court has just agreed to hear the case. It was a case of a man who had an interaction with the former vice president, Dick Cheney. It happened in a public place. The man came up to the vice president. And obviously, he was very unhappy with the Bush administration and wanted to tell the vice president so. And there were some questions about, did he touch him? Did he not? What happened there? But he was apprehended by the Secret Service. And I think the Secret Service said, look, it's our job to protect the vice president. We were just doing our job. The man made the argument. He said, no, I was not threatening the vice president. They just did this because they didn't like what I had to say. And he said it is his contention that his First Amendment rights were violated. And apparently the Supreme Court has agreed to hear this case. Does that present some interesting issues, do you think?
It really does. One of the things that we've seen over the last several years, and I will say, that was really a fixture in the Bush administration post the advent of the Iraq War, was that when the president of the United States or the vice president of the United States would travel around on public dollars and would go to a location to give a speech or to do a town hall meeting in a public space, in a public building, the tickets would be distributed for those events by people who were allies of the president's, the local Republican Party, the local Republican congressman or senator would distribute the tickets. And one of the things that we saw in addition to this case was an instance in which some people were actually singled out and banned from entering the building where the vice president was going to speak simply because they had an anti-war bumper sticker on their car. Near as I can figure out, the Secret Service has a very important job in terms of protecting the president and other constitutional officers and ensuring their safety, and we want them to do that job. But I can't find the part of the Constitution where it says that the president and the vice president never have to hear from anyone who disagree with them. And I think when they set themselves up to go out in public to use our dollars, they have to accept that people are going to criticize them and they're going to say things. And you know, there was a great deal of evidence actually in the trial court in the particular case that you cited, that this gentleman did not physically threaten the vice president in any way. He verbally stated his opposition to many of the things that the former vice president supported. And so, you know, the notion that you can be detained or stopped simply for articulating your view, I think comes as a great shock to many people. And I think it'll be very interesting to see how the court handles this case.
Mm-hmm. We have about 10 minutes left. We have some other callers here. We have two, in fact, ready to go, both in Urbana. We'll go first, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question for Mr. Yonka, and I'll hang up and listen to his reply. I'm curious how the presence of the professional anarchists that are showing up at a lot of these larger protests is affecting the free speech issue. Is it clouding the issue? And because it's been my understanding that the anarchists are there mainly just to cause chaos, and there really is no placating them and absolutely nothing that will make them happy other than creating chaos. And I would think that would hinder the people who have an actual legitimate message they want to get out. And I'm interested what the guest has to say about that.
That I think that issue is incredibly important and a practical one that has been that we've seen play out in other places and in other instances before, that there is a small minority of people who seem to travel from event to event with the sheer and sole purpose of creating havoc and disrupting either the event or, frankly, whatever city it is that where the event is taking place. Obviously, and I think the caller, you know, in terms of the way he addressed it is clear. It does take away, I think, some focus, and it often causes government to react in a way where they crack down on people who are voicing legitimate political concerns and policy concerns. And, I think that creates a problem. But I think that argues for the importance of the government agencies and entities creating plans up front and then meeting with the groups of protesters. You know, in Chicago, leading up to the G8, one of the groups that's leading the protest efforts and organizing is the American Friends Service Committee, the Quaker group that has been a nonviolent, peaceful protest organization since, you know, the advent of the 20th century. So the notion somehow, you know, that government could sit down across a table from them and talk about these problems and I think, you know, frankly, come to solutions that would not permit the concern, legitimate, perhaps, over the small number of anarchists to block out the broader ability of people to speak freely.
Another caller, Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
On the police being recorded by people, that goes back, if you don't know the history, and I believe your caller said he wasn't sure, it goes back to the politicians in Chicago a long time ago that were recorded doing what people call the Chicago way and being convicted for doing what they did. So immediately the legislature passed laws that said you can't have one party consent in the state of Illinois because none of them wanted to get caught doing what they shouldn't do. That's how it all started. And as far as recording the police, the problem isn't with recording the police. The police generally don't care if they get recorded. The problem is if you're close enough to hear dialogue between an officer and whoever they're dealing with, you're too close. The officer has to worry about not only what the person they're dealing with themselves, and now they have to worry about somebody else. Whether your intentions are innocent or not, that officer still has to worry about what you're doing and how close you are. You've now distracted them from doing what they're doing, and that's where the problems come in.
Well, I wouldn't disagree about the origins of the two-party consent in Illinois being linked back to some of those political scandals. I think that even the authors of the two-party consent could never have imagined that it was going to be used in this way. In terms of being too close to the officers, there's a couple of issues there. First of all, the human ear is a pretty powerful tool, and you can often hear dialogue from several feet away in which you are not actually intruding upon or in some way disrupting the activity of the officers, even though I think that's often a claim that's used. The second thing is if the officer actually feels threatened, if the officer in some way feels as though there is a disruption, he or she can order a person who's standing nearby to move along or to disperse in a way that if they don't follow that order, they'd be subject to a penalty for having done that. But it's not a felony eavesdropping penalty. And so I think the notion somehow is there has to be, you know, I don't think any of us have ever argued that there might not be instances where an officer wouldn't want to have 12 people hovering around 2 feet away with video cameras and audio cameras going. But the notion that as we walk by on the street and see some interaction happening, at the curb, if we're on the sidewalk a few feet away, that we couldn't record that if there was something we felt disturbing, I think is really the thing that's at issue here.
Yeah, just sort of to make clear, just so people understand what we're talking about, if you're talking to somebody on the telephone or if you're just sitting talking to somebody, it's illegal for you to surreptitiously record that without that. That's why our reporters, for example, when they're talking to somebody on the phone, the very first thing they always say is, "May I record this?" You have to ask the person, and they have to say yes.
Correct. And in the same way, that absent a court order or a warrant, police or anyone else have to notify people that they may be recorded. And, you know, I think, again, that's been a very good tool across the state of Illinois. Although I smile over the reference to the Chicago way, I think many of my friends would suggest it's the Illinois way as opposed to just the Chicago way. But, you know, it's something that we've seen, you know, that was the origins of this. I just don't think anyone could have ever imagined It would be applied in this way, especially given the advent of new technologies and the easy access to those technologies.
Yeah. We're coming down to the point, we have a couple minutes left. This is, again, getting back to right to privacy in public places, and this is a complicated issue. I'm sure we could spend at least a whole hour talking about that. But I guess I'm just interested, again, in this idea, because I don't know whether how people think about that, whether, in fact, they think when they're walking down the street in public, whether they have any expectation of privacy. Do they feel that there is some kind of a privacy zone, but that it's limited, what it is that the law has to say about them? I mean, do you truly have to feel that, you know, again, yes, if you're walking down the street, that there, and you're in public, whatever you're doing, there is really no right to privacy?
That really is the place we've reached, David. And I have to say, you know, living and working in Chicago and you know, where we are on Michigan Avenue, if I leave my office and I walk up the street on Michigan Avenue up the Magnificent Mile, there is literally not a step that I take that isn't recorded or captured somewhere.
Hmm.
And it is pervasive, and it is significant, and it's growing. The interlocking of private and public camera systems in a way that, you know, we just, you know, everything that we do outside of our own doors are things that are captured and recorded and perhaps saved somewhere for all we know for some period of time. So, you know, I think that it used to be in the old days, you know, it used to be that thing about you never wanted to do anything outside that your mother wouldn't be proud of because somebody else might see it and report you. Well, now it's just we you know, this is the high tech version of that. And it's a vastly more sophisticated version of it. And so I think it's something we need to adjust to. One of the things that we worry about then is, you know, what are controls on once you have that technology in place, what are the controls that are put in place with the software that accompanies it? You know, for example, the use of facial recognition technology, the use of tracking software that allows surveillance cameras to track a person from one camera to another. So you could literally, you know, one of the things we were once told was that the Chicago system would literally allow the police to track someone if they walked anywhere in the loop and to follow them on their entire course. Well, if you're going to church or you're going to a psychiatrist, or frankly, if you're going to meet someone your wife doesn't want you to be with, that's not something you want on camera. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that kind of powerful technology exists these days, and it really does limit our capacity to have anything that even closely resembles privacy in a public space.
Well, there we'll have to stop. Our guest this morning is the Director of Communications and Public Policy for the American Civil Liberties Union of Illinois, Ed Yonka. And if you're interested in this issue or others that the ACLU follows, you can go to their website, which is aclu.org. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, David.